You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is, of course, when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week. And today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Dawn Day with BoiseDev.com, and Audrey Dutton with the Idaho Capital Sun. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hello.
Happy Friday.
Hello.
Let's just get right into it. And Melissa, I want to start with the fact that we hit a 4,000 recorded COVID deaths this week in Idaho. Talk a little bit about this, because that last 1,000, which frankly, the fact that we're talking about this number is staggering, but it happened so quickly.
Right. Idaho surpassed 4,000 recorded deaths due to COVID-19 on Wednesday, and it took just 72 days to record the latest 1,000 deaths. So in comparison, it took 263 days for Idaho to hit the first 1,000 deaths from the date that the first COVID case was recorded in Idaho. From there, it was another 132 days to record the next 1,000, and 168 days to get from 2,000 to 3,000. So in other words, this was a very rapid, it was a very quick milestone. And we already knew that September and October were especially deadly months because of COVID in Idaho. This is just another metric to confirm what we already knew.
And Melissa, we also know that this, I mean, the Delta surge is also the reason why we saw so many more cases and so many more deaths.
Right. And the vast majority of those cases were among unvaccinated Idahoans. Not all of them, but the majority, the overwhelming majority. And, you know, in recent weeks, we've seen a decline in the statewide test positivity rate, or the percentage of tests that come back positive. Although, you know, last week it ticked up again very, very slightly statewide, and in certain parts of the state, like, you know, once again in the Panhandle Health District, which is still under crisis standards of care. It's the only area of the state that is still under crisis standards of care. And so, you know, it's likely, or it's one explanation for that is that post-Thanksgiving bump that, you know, we hear about, the post-holiday, everyone got together in closed quarters because cases were declining. They felt comfortable taking off their masks and getting together with family members. And so that's one possible explanation for that slight uptick. And it is a slight uptick, but it's also a reminder that just because we are you know, out of crisis standards of care, it doesn't mean that the virus has disappeared.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, Melissa, we should note that we still have low vaccination rates in comparison to other parts of the country.
Right. You know, whether you're looking at adults over 18 or the entire eligible population, you know, no matter how you slice it, we are among the lowest or the lowest, when it comes to percentage of the population that is vaccinated. There are different ways of looking at those numbers, but no matter how you do it, we have a long ways to go, especially in some parts of the state. There have been consistently, since vaccines became widely available in Idaho, a number of counties with low vaccination rates. Idaho County, Boise County, are still hovering around, you know, 32-33% of adults fully vaccinated. And so that varies a lot. You know, the Boise area of Ada County, it's a much higher rate of the vaccinated eligible population. Blaine County, almost everyone who's eligible in Blaine County has been vaccinated, according to numbers supplied by IDHW. So it does vary region by region, but statewide, the picture, as has been the entire pandemic, especially since vaccines have become widely available to everybody, not everyone's taking them up on it.
True. That is very true. And Audrey, you recently wrote a story, just a tragic and heartbreaking story, about a longtime Idaho resident who passed away from COVID. And can you talk to us about that? And frankly, the message that his wife wants to send.
Yeah. So, Buddy Fowler was one of, we do know that there are cases of breakthrough deaths, people dying of COVID mm-hmm. after being fully vaccinated. So Buddy Fowler was one of those folks who died of COVID after being fully vaccinated. He lived in Blackfoot for almost his entire life. He served, he worked at the INL and he served on Blackfoot Police Department. He and his wife, Donna Fowler, moved to a Phoenix suburb a few years back. To retire, and he loved playing golf, and so being outdoors there, he was really enjoying it. However, he had rheumatoid arthritis, which was diagnosed after he had a pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot in the lung, and he also had a heart attack during the pandemic and had to have heart surgery for that. So he had several different kinds of comorbidities, underlying conditions. And he was on immune suppressing drugs for his rheumatoid arthritis. And he caught the coronavirus. Everyone he lived with, his wife and one of her sons, they were fully vaccinated. The whole family wore masks. But, you know, as Donna told me, she would go out to the store and be one of very few people wearing a mask. And we all know at this point how masks work. Unless you're in an N95 medical grade kind of protection, then the point of wearing the mask is not only to somewhat reduce your likelihood of being able to inhale the virus, but also to protect other people. And that's the main reason for wearing a mask. So he got sick. They thought it was the flu. It felt like the flu. She got sick. And his condition deteriorated pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. She tried to get him seen at a really small hospital there, and they weren't able to admit him. They didn't have monoclonal antibodies. They referred her to a place that didn't have monoclonal antibodies. And she tried to find them on her own. She could not. So he ended up worsening and needing to be hospitalized. And in a case that I've heard about this so many times from people who've lost loved ones, she was communicating with him via text one day. He was watching baseball. He loved the Atlanta Braves. And so he was hoping to see them play Boston Red Sox in the World Series. Anyway, so they were talking back and forth about that. And it seemed like he was feeling better. The doctor was hopeful. 2 hours later, she gets a call saying, "Hey, we need your permission to intubate him and put him under and run a central line to be able to give him mm-hmm. IVs. IV bags." And he was intubated for a week. And the last time she saw him was the day that he died. She went in there and she said she counted more than 20 bags of medication and fluids. And her message is, don't forget about people who have underlying conditions. And you can be doing, you know, an individual can be doing everything to keep themselves safe. Buddy was doing everything right. The family was doing everything right. Unfortunately, people in the community weren't. And so that's how you end up getting infected if you're doing everything right. And she, you know, the first time I talked to her, she said, "Are you going to be writing this story as though like the vaccines don't work?" And I said, "No, that's not my intention. I want to be able to tell a story about someone who had a breakthrough case. We've heard about these." She was really concerned about people taking away the wrong message from this, that vaccines don't work. Worked for her and worked for her son very well. But Buddy didn't develop the robust immune response that that he needed to be able to protect himself. And so, yeah, her message is take care of the people in your community by getting vaccinated and wearing masks and social distancing, all the stuff that we've been hearing from public health officials.
Right. And that's the whole thing. And I think that's why it's important to tell his story, because I think so many people, Audrey, would think, well, you know, see, they're naysayers, the vaccines don't work. It's like, no, they do. But as a community, we all have to do our part.
Right. That's the whole idea of herd immunity or community immunity. I mean, we talk about the vaccine efficacy and with flu shots in the same way. You know, you might be just fine with the flu, but think about, you know, the 85-year-old who lives next door to you, or or a child who's going through cancer treatment.
Dawn, let's switch gears a bit because a proposed event center in McCall, is it getting some people fired up? And I have to say, I was kind of surprised because I thought, well, yeah, I mean, in when you look at it on paper, you're like, yeah, McCall could use an event center, but that's apparently not how a lot of people feel.
Yeah, you know, anytime somebody wants to do something that is unique, I think that we see lots of questions and some pushback. And as Boise Dev's Autumn Robertson reported this week, a group of folks in McCall hopes to build an event center over kind of on the southwest part of town. So not, I wouldn't say super close to the lake, off kind of off by itself, frankly. But people in the neighborhood are not happy and see some potential challenges. This is on Rio Vista Boulevard. It's currently home to kind of a bed and breakfast area called Northwest Passage, as it has been for decades. But the current owners want to turn it into Cloud Nine, which they call an event center and vacation rental spots. They're saying, hey, you know what? This preserves the character of the town. It fits right in with McCall and is something that we think would go here. It went to planning and zoning last week, and folks weren't pleased. You know, it struck me, one of the first quotes that Autumn used was from a McCall resident, John Sanchez. And he said, "We purchased our home a year ago. We love this neighborhood. It's a quiet neighborhood." And that was kind of the sentiment, I think, from most people, which was, hey, this is quiet. Why are we going to put an event center in here? So the Planning and Zoning Commission up there said, hey, you know what? We're going to hold off on this a little bit. We're going to defer this and come back. We believe that they'll do that at their next meeting in the new year. So whether or not this happens or not, I'm just not sure. There are so many forces of growth in McCall that are certainly causing some concern. Some of those are as simple as the Pancake House closing on Sunday for a number of factors. And some of them are larger. And people up there are really trying to get their hands around how McCall goes forward in a time of tremendous change, really for growth all across Idaho, but especially in these key places that are resort towns.
Well, right. And the thing is, too, is when you think about McCall, Dawn, I mean, it's small, it's quaint. And every time you go up there, it seems like there's something new.
Yeah, it's interesting. You say small and quaint. Autumn wrote the story and I went and pulled up the planning and zoning packet to see if there were any good renderings or art for this story. And as I was scrolling through the like 1,000-page document looking for renderings, I kept seeing all of these proposals for just massive houses. And I'm not denigrating anybody who can build a massive house, but there was one where I think I recognized the property along the lake in town. And it's currently a fairly modest lakefront home. And the new rendering was just a massive home. And so those types of things are going to cause concern. We're going to continue to see it. And political leaders in McCall, residents in McCall, longtime residents in McCall, and frankly, newcomers are all going to kind of have their say and hash this out as we start to see, I hate to use the word transformation, but as we start to see some transformation up there.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. Continuing our reporter roundtable, our panel today, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Dawn Day with BoiseDev.com, and Audrey Dutton with Idaho Capital Sun. So Audrey, fill us in on Dr. Ryan Cole. As some people know, he is a member of the Central District Health Board, but now he's been removed from one of the state's largest health systems.
Right. So St. Luke's Health Partners is a health insurance network, which essentially it contracts between health insurance companies and healthcare providers. So American healthcare system, very convoluted. So the network includes physicians from St. Luke's, as well as independent providers. And basically, it's like when you go to the doctor and they need to run a lab test on you, blood test, or get a biopsy in particular, that would be sent to a lab. And if the lab is in network, that's probably where it's going to go. So, so Dr. Cole is no longer in the St. Luke's Health Partners network. And I was not able to confirm whether this was St. Luke's Health Partners' decision or if it was Dr. Cole's decision, because he didn't respond to me. And St. Luke's cited the peer review law, Idaho's peer review law, for why it was unable to explain how, you know, how that happened. But it's significant in that we have narrow health insurance networks in Idaho, meaning they're limited to certain networks. Select health plans are a really good example. So essentially, patients without Select Health, or who have Select Health right now, or soon, Dr. Cole's laboratory will not be a network for them. And several other plans too that have these narrow network kind of setups. So unclear why it happened, but it is a big deal. As KTVB's Brian Holmes, the 208, reported as well, Boise VA has kind of distanced themselves from him as a consultant. They're no longer using him as a consultant. And also, Crush the Curve Idaho, which was sending COVID test samples to him, is no longer. And these are the kind of the reasons that they cited were how he's been speaking about COVID publicly and encouraging people not to get vaccinated, encouraging certain people not to get vaccinated, and warning that the vaccines falsely will hurt you and kill you and things like that. So remains to be seen what will happen after this, but that's kind of the latest.
And Melissa, we know that there's kind of been a pause on these federal vaccine mandates, but what kind of impact is this having or could have on higher ed?
Well, right now we're waiting to see. There's a stay. A federal judge issued a stay on the part of the vaccine and testing mandate that affected federal contractors. And there were some universities that interpreted that to mean, because they receive, you know, nearly $90 million in federal grants, that the mandate applied to university employees and student employees. So not the students, but anybody who works for the university. So now that the stay has been issued by that federal judge, there was a pending deadline at Boise State University for its employees. That, you know, is now on hold. The State Board of Education president and Governor Brad Little both said that that was the decision that they hoped the judge would make, and that they hope that stay stands, that the mandate will not be enforced. And so right now, just like with all the different parts of the mandate, the one that applies to private employers with more than 100 employees, the one that applies to healthcare workers, those are all on hold. They have been stayed, and everything is up in the air right now. There's no surprise. I think that anyone who's been following the story was expecting those court challenges to put a hold on things, or at least put some uncertainty into the conversation before there is an actual ruling on how or if this will proceed.
Yeah. So Dawn, if anyone has been in downtown Boise recently, there's a beautiful Christmas tree in front of the Idaho Capitol building. We see this every year. This tree was donated by a Boise family, but maybe it wasn't supposed to be taken down the way it was.
Oh boy. Yeah. This is the most read story of the year on Boise Dev. I'm somewhat ashamed to admit.
Yeah.
We do lots of hard-hitting journalism here, but people really
and then this.
Stories. Yeah. So our managing editor, Gretchen Parsons, tracked this down last week. And here's what happened. As happens each year, the state of Idaho looks for a donation of a beautiful tree that a homeowner no longer wants on their property to be put up on the steps of the state house capitol and strung with lights. I walked over to take a picture last week, and it is particularly beautiful this year. What happened is this tree was cut from a residence on Harrison Boulevard in Boise. And the city of Boise has a historic district in the area that prevents a number of things. You know, if you own a home on Harrison, you own the property, but just as if you live in Boise County, you have to get a building permit to make a change. The city of Boise has decided you have to get a certificate of appropriateness to make changes. The idea being they want to preserve the historic character of the area. That did not happen here. The Idaho Department of Administration told Gretchen that they just goofed up, essentially. They said that the tree was posing an obvious threat to the structure. It was planted too close to the home. Obviously, the tree grew over 40 years. It wasn't too close when they put it in, but trees get bigger, as you are aware. The state approached the homeowners and asked if they were willing to donate the tree, and they said, sure. What's interesting is Executive Assistant Kim Rao told Boise Dev that, quote, every step of the project was coordinated and executed perfectly. The city of Boise disagrees. They say that this is a violation of the code. City of Boise spokesperson Justin Kaur said that there are ways to rectify this. We looked up the code, and it does say it's a misdemeanor and could be punishable by a fine of not more than $1,000. Justin told us that you can mitigate this by replacing trees. Now, you can't plant a tree that's 40 years old, but you could take a tree that was like a 24-inch caliper and plant 12 2-inch caliber trees in its place, as an example. So it's just kind of one of those things where things weren't done maybe exactly correctly. I've had a couple people since we ran the story say, well, but how does that work? You know, the state I know has claimed in the past that like state or city laws and ordinances don't necessarily apply to the state, which is a good question. There is some debate on that matter. But even so, the tree was cut from private property, not from state of Idaho property. And so the ordinance would apply. The state told us that they're going back now and trying to get the appropriate permit. And they're working through that process and have been this week.
I just feel bad for these homeowners, honestly, Don, where they just thought, I mean, they're approached, right? So they say yes. And now they might, you know, they're frankly going to be the ones on the hook if the city wanted to.
Sure.
You know,
from a strict interpretation. Yes. We didn't name the homeowners. We didn't talk to them because it really isn't strictly on them. This is, you know, the state did this, the state cut it down. They're working through it. I don't get the sense that the city's going to try and, you know, find them for the tree. But it is one of those things that, you know, the headline for us was simple. It just said Idaho's state capitol Christmas tree cut down illegally. And a lot of people just kind of wanted to read that and wondered what happened.
Well, I appreciate knowing now. We'll take a quick break. More with our reporter roundtable next. Continuing our reporter roundtable, our panel, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Audrey Dutton with the Idaho Capital Sun. So, Melissa, I'm sure you're just counting down the days until the new Idaho legislative session begins in about a month. But with that said, the House Ethics Committee is considering some rule changes, correct?
Right. After this year's high-profile ethics hearings, one with former Representative Aaron Von Ellinger and one with Representative Priscilla Giddings, there was a lot of feedback, and not a lot of it was good, from House members who weren't happy with the way that those hearings were conducted. And everything from not being happy with how public some of those proceedings were, to the fact that the lawmakers who were the subject of those investigations had to pay for their own lawyers. There were a lot of suggestions that were on the table. The House Ethics Committee met this week over the course of 2 days and talked about some of those suggestions. They didn't reach any conclusions. It was a brainstorm session, a formal discussion, I will say. Our producer Ruth Brown had had an interview with one of the committee members, Representative Brent Crane, about some of those suggestions. And part of that interview airs tonight on this week's Idaho Reports at 8 p.m. It's a wonky issue, but it gets at this bigger conversation about the standards that we hold elected representatives to and how those representatives hold each other accountable. And I think that's the part that really matters to the voters. You know, we can talk all day about the ins and outs of these wonky rules, but this is really about that higher standard that, you know, those elected representatives are held to.
No, right. Absolutely. Don, a real engineering pioneer and also a longtime Boise resident, passed away this week. But, you know, for folks who may have just recently been moving to the area may not know about this individual.
Gosh, you know, I really like to write about the history of this valley. Jack Lemley worked at Morrison Knudsen, which was a major construction firm. And we're not talking about locally, we're talking about worldwide. Worked there for about 20 years. After he left MK, he was passed over for the CEO job. He went on to chair 5 firms that helped build the Channel Tunnel that went from England to France. And this is a project that first, as I was doing the research, it was amazing, first popped up as an idea in the time of Napoleon in the early 1800s. And they tried and tried and tried and just couldn't get it. And Lemley took over this chairmanship and got it done. And obviously he didn't bore the tunnel himself. He led lots of people. I'm gun shy after saying that trees grow. So I'll just be really clear. And, you know, Lemley was born in Idaho and did this big project and did all these things across his career, helped on the 2012 Olympics, worked on the Holland Tunnel, and even worked on the Idaho State Capitol renovation a few years ago. And so he passed away this past month, late in November, and it really left a big impact on the Valley. His wife, Pam Lemley, that name might be familiar, is the co-owner with Jill Simplot of the East End Market, the old Roosevelt Market, and really had a big impact in the Treasure Valley community. And as I was researching the story, I found an old Idaho Statesman story from 2011, and Sandra Forrester, who was a reporter for them at the time, asked him how he'd like to be remembered. And boy, writing an obituary and finding a question like that in a story is great. And so I'll quote from that. He said, "I'm a builder who has always worked at the sharp end of the stick. I don't want to be known as some fantastic engineer. I'm not. But I'm a builder who learned his lessons right in the mud, and I've been able to take those lessons and translate them into very successful projects like the Channel Tunnel." Jack Lemley died at 86 of natural causes, and the last thing I'll say here is he was recognized by Queen Elizabeth II, who awarded him the Order of the British Empire. And so that's just a little bit about somebody who made an impact here in Boise and around the world.
Yeah, it was a beautiful tribute, Don. Don, we have just about a minute left, but I do want to, if you could quickly talk about this new census data about Idaho getting more diverse. I mean, we should clarify, I mean, not a ton more diverse, but we are starting to see some.
No, it's important to say Idaho is still overwhelmingly white in its racial makeup, but it is getting more diverse. In 2010, the population was 84% white, and in the 2020 census, it was 79% white. So it dropped 5%. And what's interesting is some of these groups are growing really fast. The number of Hispanics in Idaho boomed. The number of Black Idahoans grew by a lot. Folks of Asian descent grew. There's a lot of data to this and some really interesting maps. And without trying to get this in a minute, you can look at BoiseDev.com where we really drill in on each of the individual demographic groups and what they look like. And what's really fun is these maps from big local news and the Associated Press actually let you drill down by county or by census tract. So you can see what kind of your neighborhood looks like in terms of change. And Ada County is getting more diverse, Canyon County is getting more diverse. And while the state is certainly still one of the least diverse in the country, there are some changes starting to happen. And it's just really fascinating to see.
Yeah, I think so too. And remember, folks, if you want more information on that, do go to BoiseDev.com and read that. Also, tune in to Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television this evening at 8 p.m. And of course, you can read all of Audrey Dutton's reporting at the Idaho Capital Sun. Thanks, everybody, for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thank you.
Absolutely. We've been talking with Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Audrey Dutton with the Idaho Capital Sun. We'll have more Idaho Matters next.